This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Thank you, Julianne, for agreeing to talk to us for our new episode. To begin, I'd like to ask you to briefly introduce yourself.
I'm Julianne Boudreau, and I'm a professor at the National Institute for Scientific Research in Montreal, Canada, and also at the Institute of Geography at the UNAM in Mexico City.
Thank you, Julianne. So we got in touch with you primarily because of our interest in the recent book that you published on global urban politics, and we'd like you to briefly summarize some of the insights from that book, about which we will try to draw linkages later on to the current situation.
Sure. Well, the book is arguing that we are now living in the world of cities, in the sense that urban cultures are hegemonic, and they define how we interact, how we act, and a large part of our worldviews across the world. And the fact that we live in such a hegemonic urban culture affects the political process, in the sense that the way we engage politically in the world works differently than in the world of nation states. The book doesn't argue that the nation state is disappearing, of course not, but it does argue that there are new elements in our way of conceiving the world that actually affects the way politics work. So the book looks at that at three levels of analysis. Institutionally, for instance, we're looking at the power relations between cities and national states, for instance. So the architecture of the state is something that has been discussed in various analysis before about the state restructuring process under globalization. But the book also looks at how this world of city is affecting interpersonal relationships and the logics of political action, collective action, in different places. This is what I call in the book the urban logic of action. I can come back to this later. And then the third level at which I'm looking at these changes of the political process is at the ontological level of our worldviews. The fact that we live in cities changes our relationship to space, time, and rationality. So in that sense, it does change the way we see the world and thus the way we act in the world. So one of the things that the book argues is that this urbanization of the world informalizes the state. So it's this idea that the national state is changing in the sense that it's informalizing, in the sense that the boundaries between the state, the market, and civil society are not as clear anymore with these forces of urbanization, and that the national state and the state in general at all levels of government no longer has the monopoly over the distribution of justice and authority.
Thank you, Julianne, for that summary. It's an excellent book. Thoroughly recommend it. Thinking about your main arguments there, how do you think we can approach the COVID-19 situation, perhaps particularly the political reaction to it, with this kind of understanding, with these concepts in hand?
Well, obviously, one of the main critiques of the book was that I was emphasizing too much that the national state no longer had that much of an importance. And well, this is not what I was trying to argue in the book. I was instead trying to argue that we may want to also look somewhere else for politics in urban life. But when we see the situation right now, with the closing of national boundaries, with the really robust national state measures all over the world, right, to face the COVID-19 situation, it seems like the national state does have quite a lot of weight and importance in managing the crisis. However, what I'm observing right now is that also, even though these measures are enforced through the army or any other, the police force or surveillance mechanisms all over the world, I mean, with differences according to the countries, sometimes the state has difficulty in imposing these measures on city life. For many city dwellers, at least from where I'm speaking, in Mexico City, these measures are not necessarily convincing. Perhaps my take on it is that the approach with which these state measures are justified, the way these state measures are justified is hyper-rational. It's really based on scientific medical rationality. And in many ways, this doesn't speak at all to people's everyday values and everyday life. Let me give you an example. So I'm speaking here from Mexico City, where there's half the population living, vending stuff on the street, food or other merchandise. So they're really living on a daily basis. The informal sector is huge, and they live with cash money circulating. So the money they earn selling stuff will be the money they will use to buy food for their family at night, right? So they really depend on street life. The confinement measures in a city such as Mexico City are really a class privilege. If you look at different areas of the city, you will see in the middle class areas people are in their house, but it's not the case in many other areas where people actually have to go out if they want to eat. There is no kind of state security net to provide for people who really depend on this type of work. So what happens is that for many people, whatever scientific argument you will give them to convince them of staying home, or civic argument, do it because we need to save lives, or these sorts of argument, are really not having much effect. What's important to them is really earning a living, and they have other sorts of rationalities guiding their lives. And not only in these popular sector, in many other classes or socioeconomic sectors of the society as well, other rationalities that are more based on beliefs, on emotions, on affect, on solidarity, are much more important than the scientific arguments that governments use to justify the measures they put in place. For example, we're approaching Easter weekend in Mexico City right now. It's Semana Santa, and normally, this Friday, there would be a huge procession staging the Passion of Christ in one of the peripheral areas of the city. Normally, more than 1 million people will attend this event. Now, what these people say is that we're not going to cancel it because God will save us. You know, the coronavirus won't touch me because I'm protected by God. Obviously, the authorities are trying to cancel this event. But the thing is these rationalities are clashing, and national states have traditionally been using this scientific rationality to justify its policies and its measures. And what I'm arguing in the book is that there's a number of other rationalities and worldviews that are guiding what people do, and this urban logic of action, these different rationalities that we can sense on the street and in urban cultures and in urban daily life are really important and more visible. Even though right now what we see is that the boundaries are closed and the state is taking quite a lot of strong measures, perhaps looking at other places where politics takes place closer to people's everyday lives and their way of doing things and their rationalities may also be more effective for state measures right now.
Think about the urban logic of action and this urban logic of politics, really, how that works differently. Could you say a little bit more about that in relation to this, the contrast to state logics of action, and perhaps looking forward, how you think these tensions might play out a little bit in places like Mexico City?
Mm-hmm. Well, the urban logic of action, first of all, is it's contrasted conceptually to a state-centered logic of action, but they're not mutually exclusive. I want to make that clear, right? It's not one or the other. But let's say, for the benefit of conceptual clarity, let's contrast them, right? So first of all, if in a hegemonic urban cultural world in which we're living right now, the fact that city life, even though people don't live in cities, is dominating in the way the world is lived and governed right now. This affects our relationship to the way we conceive of space, time, and affect. So how does this translate in the way we act? So if we look at it in terms of space, well, the most obvious element of the urban logic of action is that action is taking place in a networked more than a bounded spaces of action. So the obvious example of this is the role of social media, right, in politics right now. The fact that people don't necessarily think of their spaces of political action as a bounded space, right, like the national state, for instance. In terms of temporality, one of the arguments of the book is that urbanity, living in an urban world, changes our relationship to time, and time is central to political action. For instance, much of the social movement politics of the 20th century was based on the notion of progress, right? So, or of revolution. This idea that it's a linear time, right? We're acting right now in order to produce a better future. Not that this is no longer valid, but much of the forms of political action that I describe in the book is based on the here and now, on acting here and now, on doing it here and now, not necessarily strategizing for a better future. Not that there are no strategies, of course, but that tactical action and do-it-yourself action and prefigurative action, in the sense of doing it now, is something very important in the way we see political action nowadays. So tactics more than strategic action. In terms of rationality, continuing on what I was saying before, of course, ideology and rational deliberation is something still important in politics, but there are also a number of other registers of political action that are very visible in cities, which have to do with affect, with emotion, with visceral reactions to whatever is happening in everyday life. And this also nurtures political action in a very visible way in many social movements that we've seen in the past decade or so. A fourth element of this urban logic of political action is the fact that actors are not that easily identifiable. This is what I like to call some kind of a post-heroic vision of action. This, in many ways, it's more of a methodological point. It's this idea that perhaps to locate, to see political action, we have to look at the sequence of gestures, of action and reaction in specific places and in specific moments, instead of looking for leaders of a political movement. If you look at a situation of action and you describe it, it's not that obvious who the actors are. The actors emerge out of the situation. It's not necessarily that you have leaders in their headquarters planning an action and strategizing. Not that this doesn't happen, but you can also see emerging political action through improvisation and through these action-reaction, these sequence of gestures in specific moments and in specific places. So actors are not necessarily the main element, the leaders are not necessarily the main element to understand political action. And the final element that I describe in the book to speak of an urban logic of action is this idea that politics don't necessarily emerges from resistance and antagonism, in the sense of a resistance to the state or to global capitalism or etc. This could be the case, of course, but there are many, many political gestures, instances of political action that are simply impulsed from everyday situation. So it's in this sense that I say in the book, urban life is political life, is the sense that in many ways, what makes people becoming politically engaged is oftentimes a very banal situation in everyday life, and they, from one small decision to the other, they will become more and more involved in a political situation. So impulsion, and not only resistance and antagonism, is one of the elements that I can see in these changes in the political process that we see right now. And I insist, this doesn't mean that more classical ways of looking at political action as resistance, as organized, as something that is strategized and planning for the future and rational, etc., doesn't exist anymore, of course not. But that there are more and more instances, or they're more visible, of other sorts of political action that are perhaps less visible in the public debate. So what I think we can do with this concept in order to analyze the current situation is three things. And in the immediate situation we're in, where we're still in the middle of a crisis, right? It can help us assess the effectiveness of the measures, as I was mentioning at the beginning, the level of acceptance, the level of integration in everyday life. And what I see is that the state right now, these measures are following a more traditional, what I would call state logic of action, you know, rational, with a linear conception of time. This is for a better future, you know, this is the management of the crisis, etc. And there's a clash with the way people live the crisis right now and the way people understand it and the way people process it and respect or not the measures that are put in place. So if the state were to use other arguments, other rationalities, or were to try to implement this not necessarily through the army or the police on the street whatsoever, and use instead other measures that are closer to people's everyday lives, perhaps these measures would have a greater effect. But also, I think there's a lot of reflection and discussion right now about what will cities be after the COVID-19 crisis. And of course, this is changing completely urban daily life right now. But if we look at it from this urban logic, the relationship to the future is not linear in many ways. What I see with this urban logic of action is that people clung to hope and what are the creative possibilities that we can from which we can build another type of cities right after the crisis. So in many ways, instead of thinking of it as we are in a crisis right now and afterwards, you know, we will come back to normal life whatsoever, what I see is a much more fragmented kind of reflection on the future right now, and people are doing things right now that will probably have impact after the crisis. So in terms of space, you know, in terms of the impact on our relationship to space of what's going on right now, well, obviously there's a change of scales, right? The level of networked interchanges and traveling and all of this is obviously diminishing with the closing down of boundaries and all of that, and people's everyday lives have shrunk to the very micro scale right now. But even though this kind of relationship between the global and the local is changing, I think we are still conceiving our everyday lives in a very networked manner. I don't think anyone's kind of coming back to this idea of a stable space of political action, which is the national state, because we're all connected digitally anyway. So in this sense, I think this concept of urban logic of action can help looking at the situation differently and closer to people's everyday lives than if we use a state logic to analyze the situation.
I'd like to come back to your distinction between state logics and urban logics of action, and you raised the issue on terms of how well these logics are integrated in a particular place, in a particular country, and that there might be differences. I wonder, given your familiarity with Mexico, Canada, and maybe other places, what kind of key differences do you see in terms of how well they go together or are entering into conflicts and dissonance?
Mm-hmm. For instance, right? The urban logic of action to me is a force of informalization of the state, in the sense that the state formalization, the modern state formalization in countries like Canada and Mexico. Obviously they didn't have the same degrees of formalization, right, in the sense of producing a modern liberal state, and we know that Mexico has always had a level of informality greater than Canada, for instance, to take these two examples. But even in Canada or Europe or the United States or countries where the formalization process was the most advanced, it was never complete. And I think what's important to understand is that state formalization is kind of an elastic process. It's not linear. The nature of state formalization will always stretch and contract, right? So in certain moments in history, the level of informality in the state process will be higher or lower in all countries in the world, in different ways. So the urbanizing of politics informalizes the state in the sense that the state is no longer the central interlocutor of the political process. It's not, the state is no longer the entity to which social movements are speaking to. Social movements do their things, and they don't necessarily only claim things to the state or demand things to the state. And in response, the state will thus work through a kind of a mix of written and unwritten rules and ways of doing things, right? So state informalization is kind of this blurring of the state and civil society politics in many ways. And because there are so many unwritten rules, it becomes very important to observe what's going on in city life at the street level to understand this this integration between state action and urban action, everyday life action, civil society action. So to come back to the comparison between Mexico and Canada, for instance, Mexico in elected at the federal level a very populist president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO. And so populism as a way of governing is in many ways very close to what I mean by informalization of the state. So what is the Mexican state doing right now in response to this crisis? Well, like many places in the world, we're stuck at home and there's no school and the same measures, right? There is no strong enforcement of this with police or the army, not yet at least, but and just this Sunday the president was announcing his plan for addressing the economic impacts of the crisis. And one of the things, the main thing really that is in his program, is providing direct aids in the form of a cash deposit in people's bank account if they have one, or through kind of a sort of a credit card or a voucher that they distribute to people who need help, right, in this specific situation. So it's a very populist measure. But also in his discourse, when he was announcing these measures, the president kept saying, well, don't worry, very soon we will be able to hug in public places again, right? So he's addressing very directly this affective, this emotional need that people have. And he's also not talking so much about the scientific arguments that kind of justify the need for these measures. If we look at what's going on in Canada, the measures are much more strongly enforced, and there was a law for punishing those who don't respect the confinement right now. But what's happening on the streets of Montreal, for instance, is that spring is coming and the snow is melting and it's nice outside, and anyone who knows Montreal will know that when spring comes, people become kind of crazy. They undress and they go outside and they go on the terrace, the cafes, and they have a beer and all of these things. So the temptation of spring coming and congregating on the street is very strong. And so I was speaking to a student of mine in Montreal this weekend, and he was saying, well, I'm a bit worried because with spring, people don't respect the confinement anymore. And so what we see coming out is neighbors denouncing other neighbors and calling the police to say they're congregating on the street. And so there are other mechanisms of social control that kind of developed from civil society. I'm not saying this is good or this is bad. I'm just saying that the state measures do not directly speak to people's need and to this very strong emotional need to go on the street when the snow melts. And to these are kind of registers of action that are very embodied, very visual, very effective. And the state keeps the very rational scientific argument. So the reaction of the people is to kind of take things into their own hands and just informally, spontaneously put in place other social control mechanisms for that. So these two logics of action are in a way integrated differently in different places in the world, depending on the political culture of these places and the history of state formalization and informalization.
Are there any examples in Mexico where there's been in Mexico City recently where there have been different kinds of organizational movement type things, sort of solidarity movements, anything kind of that's been generated to deal with this current situation? Thinking particularly, you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that obviously people are lower income, poorer people don't have really the privilege to self-isolate. You know, they have to go out and work on the street. Obviously it's very hard to say it's in an ongoing situation, but are you aware of any developments of that kind?
I'm not aware of anything kind of organized or very visible going on right now collectively, in the sense that Mexico is a very class divided society with huge inequalities, brutal inequalities. So in many ways, isolation is a class privilege, as I said, and fear being so strong, felt so strongly right now, especially among the middle upper class people. It kind of, to the contrary, breaks down a lot of solidarity. What I see is a number of very small individual gestures. For instance, there's a lot of musicians on the streets of Mexico City. They usually play on street corners or in markets or in public places. And right now there's not one day when there's no musicians coming in the empty streets of the middle class areas playing music and people throwing down money from their windows, for instance, to give to the musicians, right? So in the sense that what I see is that sorts of these very small micro gestures of solidarity with people, but it's nothing it's nothing organized yet, right? In the sense that it's really, really diffuse and very individualized engagement, right, with poor people. Because what I see is more like fear is dividing people more than putting them, bringing them together.
If I understand you correctly, your framework, your approach doesn't see that there is anything inevitable about the situation developing into forms of authoritarian technocracies that will gain hold or that will linger on even after the crisis has passed.
I am a much more hopeful person. In a sense, I can see the dangers, and there's definitely a need for people to be vigilant that these social control measures and the control through technologies, what happened in China, for instance, with the cell phones, right, and the control and the containment of the virus over there. And elsewhere in the world, of course, we need to be very, very vigilant about that. And of course, we need to make sure that all of the measures and the power that the army is taking right now in many countries in managing the crisis is not going to kind of settle into something permanent afterwards, right? For sure. But what I do see is that people don't necessarily accept that or don't necessarily fall for conspiracy theories or whatever other theories, you know, going around. I think people find different ways of protecting themselves and different forms of explanation and different inspirations to face the crisis right now. And I think that our role as intellectuals, our role as activists is to make these tiny gestures more visible to kind of inspire hope and develop different creative possibilities. And I think in places like Mexico, where there was more than 70 years of authoritarian governance with a single-party system, never did this authoritarian party never did it. It never controlled completely society. It's a very, very thriving urban society, and it has always been. And this is why I think this is our role to make these very invisible political gestures visible, and these alternative rationalities visible, to kind of get out of this very linear analysis of the past, the present, the future, right? And that we're on a path towards authoritarianism. This is killing action, creativity, and so I think this is. I see this as a very important political engagement that is our responsibility, really, to make these things visible. Us and us, I mean us intellectuals and activists and artists, have a very special and important role to play also in making these alternatives visible.
I think we all share our fears about what might happen with the state, when you think how quickly all the measures have been implemented, however necessary they are, it does reinforce the extent to which we're really apart from this kind of this politics, this machine type thing, and the speed with which that can be kind of mobilized is obviously frightening. But this idea of seeing like a city or seeing through the everyday decenters that in a way, I think, and that's something this urban logic of action, for me at least, provides a way of thinking about it in a more hopeful way. or a way of starting a conversation about it, at least, would be a way of characterizing it.
The conversation really made a very nice arc from the diagnosis to some sort of outlook. So I'd really like to say thank you, Julianne, for taking your time and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you for the invitation. It was a pleasure.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.